you. My name is Bruce Riley. I'm a board member of Voice the Ex-Offender. I'm also a founding member of the National Formerly Incarcerated Convicted Peoples Movement. And I am someone who worked with a group of people in Rhode Island in 2006 to restore voting rights to people on probation and parole through the ballot. And we did a popular ballot initiative, and we got 51% of the vote. We did a lot of work on it. Some years later, I came down here to go to school, and I lost my right to vote. So I actually wrote my own right to vote in Rhode Island and then lost it to go to law school, of all ironies of all things. So then I started doing a little research. That's the kind of thing I do, and I wanted to look into what is the law in Louisiana, and where does it come from? Many of you in this room, I'm sure, are familiar with the Farrakhan case in the Ninth Circuit, who felt that the criminal justice system has a disparate impact. And they agreed with that. And then they ended up reversing themselves and said, well, even though it has a disparate impact, it wasn't with a discriminatory intent. And so then I would say to some voting rights attorneys, well, what do you think of that case was in a covered jurisdiction? How would that, under Section 5, how would that go down a little bit differently, perhaps? And, of course, a few eyebrows were raised. So people in this room might also be familiar with Hunter v. Underwood, a 1985 Supreme Court case, which found that in Alabama, that people who were convicted of crimes of moral turpitude who lost their voting rights shouldn't lose their voting rights because that crime was created to target black people. And they had the historical record to back that up. And so that proved that felon disenfranchisement is not without oversight. And proved that if you take what seems to be a neutral policy, criminal conviction, but then you look at the criminal conviction, and was that neutrally created? And then you're going to find some relief. So I started looking at the Louisiana historical record, and there's 11 constitutions since 1812, and I read them all. And it was quite an adventure. So in 1812, there was felon disenfranchisement, but it was, quote, the privilege of free suffrage shall be supported by laws regulating elections and prohibiting all undue influence thereupon from power, bribery, tumult, or other improper practices. So they wanted to have clean elections, and so they said that if you have a perjury, bribery, forgery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors conviction, which as we know, it applies to public officials, not to just regular folks, I can't have a high crimes and misdemeanor conviction. So those people couldn't vote. That's a rational relationship. That makes some sense. Okay, there's a substantial government interest in folks that have perhaps a voter fraud conviction from voting again. But it doesn't apply to just regular folks. Now, keep in mind, of course, only white people could vote. Yes. So, there are other ways to restrict to the proper voters as the power saw fit. So then in 1845, they added, under conviction of any crime punishable with hard labor. So there's a few things under that. Under, which is a temporary status, which can end, and hard labor. So then in 1868, as we know, in the meantime, they repealed all the constitutions, seceded from the Union. So 1868 was kind of the first new statehood constitution, the Carpetbag Constitution. So in that one, they have those convicted of treason, perjury, bribery, forgery, or other crime punishable in the penitentiary. So we kind of know what that means, right? You're in the penitentiary. Now, then things start to get a little bit funny. So in 1870, the legislature decides that people who participate in the rebellion can regain their voting rights back. And at the same time, they slipped in punished by imprisonment. Just a slight little prepositional change. And it kind of opens up a few different interpretations, not necessarily to people who are in prison. And I'm sorry if I'm getting really nerdy and boring here, but this is just the way these things have to go down. So the key is, then they got the people know about the convict release program. And so they're using penitentiary as a way to get folks to work. And we know what kind of folks are being rounded up to work. We know the crimes that were created. So very similar to the moral turpitude situation we got in Alabama. Now the master stroke came in 1896 when they decided that in 2 years we're going to have a constitutional convention. And that constitutional convention is going to have full power to do anything without going to the voters. So the problem they had at the time, in 1897, there were 294,000 registered voters. 164,000 were white, 130,000 were, quote, colored. Now that was like, a little bit of advantage, but nothing, big time. But among those who write their names, it was 133,000 to 33,000. So all they had to do was come up with a literacy test, and they could change it big time. So 1 year later, they cut the voting, the registered voters, by two-thirds, down to 87,000, but also increased the impact, so whites now control 87% of the vote. So now they dictated who those members of the delegation were going to be, and we know who they were, and they went in there, and they said things, opening statements. But for the existence of that one question, the assemblage would not be sitting here today. We know that this convention has been called together by the state to eliminate from the electorate the mass of corrupt and illiterate voters who have, during the last quarter of a century, degraded our politics. This is in 1898. So they want to create the everlasting foundation of right and justice, and the convention's work may be left to the verdict of history. We're here now. Now, keep in mind, every time that in that convention, in those remarks, they mentioned disenfranchisement of, quote, Negroes, there was a standing ovation. And if you read the stuff I read, the notes of the Constitutional Convention, it says right in there, applause. Every time they talk about taking away the black vote, applause. And they talk about collateral damage. I'm one of those collateral damage people. They're like, okay, if we disenfranchise all these people under different ways, we can't use the words race, we're going to knock out some white folks, but overall, we're going to control the percentages. So, going back to what Nora said, you know, there's 6 million people, about 7 million people who are disenfranchised. 110,000 people in Louisiana. 70,000 of those are black folks. Okay, amongst black voting age population, about 7% are disenfranchised. These are getting into real numbers, right? This isn't just like 0.5%. Now, across Louisiana, 3%. So I'm in the 3%. Other folks that I know are in the 7%. And so these are real numbers, and I think that people need to really take a close look at the rules and the laws and where they came from. Even the law now says you may be disenfranchised. However, the legislature came up with some interpretations and details that makes it mandatory. I'm not in a may position. I can't just possibly go and vote. No, it's guaranteed. So I'll just, I guess, cut my remarks short, but let you know that in the U.S. v. Blewett case, which was the crack cocaine disparity case recently in the past year, what the judge there said that was basically, if you know something has a disparate impact and you continue to do it, you have discriminatory intent. And I think on felon disenfranchisement, we've known for at least a good 30 years, 40 years, about the disparate impact. And it just so happens that the laws really changed perfectly with the drug war, which was launched in 1971. And we've seen these numbers grow and grow and grow. And if we think about the drug war, and if we think about other things, and just ask yourself, if those teenaged, young 20s folks that live in predominantly communities of color, if they're being policed at the same rate as those kids who are smoking pot and doing other things on college campuses, we think those policing rates are the same, then maybe we can say the conviction rates might be a little bit similar. If we think those conviction rates are a little bit similar, then maybe the disenfranchisement is similar. But we know dang well that the policing is a choice and it's done in certain communities at a very high rate, and thus we end up with disenfranchisement at a very high rate. So we know that the criminal justice system has a disparate impact. We can debate the discriminatory intent, but we also know that we've known that, and then we can impute the discriminatory intent. You know, in Maine and Vermont, they allow universal suffrage. Prisoners vote. I've never heard of a problem. Many states have a much more permissive voting structure than Louisiana. We don't hear problems about formerly incarcerated people voting, people on probation voting. I'll pay taxes for another 25 years if I stay in Louisiana and never get the right to vote. I lost my citizenship. I'm going to have a law degree in this country, and I'm going to lose my citizenship. People will say it's my own fault, and I say, well, look at your democracy and decide if this is the type of democracy that you want to have. Thank you.
I have a question for Ms. Onion.